People of the United Kingdom, my fellow Britons, open your nostrils wide, stretch out your fingers, round your eyes to their uttermost, extend your tongue to its farthest reach, but more than this, more, quite dreadfully more, fling wide the porches of your ears unto their darkest caverns. All senses serve, but for the next 45 of your puny earth minutes, it is oral pleasures that await you, for this, in all its thisness, is the sound of Saturday Night Fry. The foeman fleck of fortune's tide have beached great richness on the strand, here on the shoreline, where wireless meets world, where wavelength meets matter. Flung on the rock, gasping and flopping for breath, a rich catch of guestery today. Slithering first into my keep net and ready for the pot, I see comic creator, screenwriter and demigod Richard Curtis. Next media prince, spinner of that which is spun, the imageer of choice amongst those who know, Howell James. Multimedia princess, software queen, entrepreneur of the digital debutantes, Sue Thexton. Kazakhstani virtuoso, violinist of tone, richness, form and beauty, Marat Bisengaliev. Welcome back the scourge of the Draylon generation, flail of the Le Creuset classes, and hero of hope and dread, John Sessions. And how lucky we are. His very initials are DNA. Writer, gamester, thinker, comic processor, a friend of rare beasts, and a rare beast of a friend, Douglas Adams. They are snatched in my net. See how they tumble into my pot. What flavors and scents and textures are there? Tuck in your napkins, smack your lips, and loosen your belts. Saturday Night Fry is served. And as the mighty Wurlitzer of Roy Wooten and Bob Barrett playing Over the Waves fades away like a quite terrible smell, this is Stephen Fry welcoming you to what will be. Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between, what is happening to our world? Once it was knowable, safe, ordered, snug and secure. A Bakelite handset weighing 4.5 pounds connected you to the village exchange. Mrs. Maunstaple delivered eggs, and the glowing coals heated the front of Mummy's legs as she sat sewing and you knelt by her, listening with Mother. Jack DeManio was precisely your friend. Sunblessed was good enough. Constipation a small price to pay for certainty. Lemongrass was a contradiction in terms, and it was more than water at a pinch, soda water siphons otherwise. Home and colonial, the tarry smell of Vosine, so emphatically not formulated and controlled by Laboratoire Garnier Paris. A good canister of Vim, Daddy's wrist on the wheel of the Wolseley, and as you whoosh down headfirst on the slide in the park, only the click of your buttons on the metal of the chute hot in the sun and the quack of the ducks, soon to be fed with soppy crusts of sunblessed, invaded your ears. Wooden tops and Christopher Trace, snake belts and Atco lawnmowers in the sun, in the sun-blessed garden of yesterday. What went wrong? Oh, what happened? Push the genie of progress back into the bottle of innocence. Video streaming, UK horizons, ISDN. This is Sky Movies Gold. Hot desking, shockwave, Netscape. Postscript 3, sunrise billionaires. Facts, facts, facts. The email of the species is more deadly than the mail. Web, web, web. PDA, PCM, CIA. Companded bandwidth, 56K flex. Digital ready, plug in and play. www.tesco.shoppinglistwedeliver.co.uk. Pay-per-view, paperless office. Communication is power. It is IT, information technology. Once we had space to drink cider, now we are tetra-packed into cyberspace. The barbarian are at the gates. The barbarians are the gates. Bill Gates. Yet I love it. I love it. The whole mess and nonsense of it. Could I live without it? Technically, of course I could. Do I want to? No. I am more powerful than Louis XIV. So are you. In a second, I can find things, know things, communicate in a way that he, in all his pomp and power, never could. He had power of life and death over others, not the kind of power I want. He did not have the power to talk to strangers across the world. He couldn't stand in a quarter of an acre of Asda space and see the bounty and merchandise of 5 continents spread out before him. But we pay. Yes, we pay for it. The bill isn't even in yet, but we must shudder at the thought of what it might be. If Forster was right, and I think he was, only Connect is a good flag to fly under. But he didn't mean iPhone and JFax and email and sex lines. Oh dear, dearie dear. Seeing wood for trees, babies, bathwater, swings, roundabouts, problems ahead. Golly, I've got just the people clustered around the green bays today to help me out. But first, let's just whiz around. We were often asked if we could do without the television. Which of us here, I wonder, could do without a computer for a year, or at a pinch, a fax machine if you don't have a computer? Richard, let me ask you first, Richard Curtis.
I've forgotten how to write without my computer. I've absolutely forgotten how to do it. When I'm trying to formulate a thought, I find it impossible to do. I think within a year I could learn again how to live without it.
But it would take you that year.
It'd be a tricky year.
Yeah. How, James?
No, I'd live without it.
Easily?
Yeah.
And faxes?
Yes, probably. Yeah, I'd get on the phone a lot. Love to chat.
Johnny Sessions?
I'm exactly the same as Richard, and you of all people, Stephen, must find that very hard to believe, because you installed my computer and taught me as if I was a dribbling three-year-old how to use it, and it took me ages to do it, but no, very, very difficult.
Now you're codependent.
I guess I am.
Marat, what about you? Are you a computer person?
Well, I do love gadgets, yes, but I could live easily without.
What about you, Sue Sexton?
No, absolutely not.
Is that just because of your work?
Committed. Yeah. No, I use it a lot personally. I'm one of these sad people that takes it on holiday with me, so no.
Excellent. Douglas?
I couldn't possibly. Absolutely not. I was in a hotel in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I suddenly discovered I hadn't got the right cable to connect my computer to that. Having been on an aeroplane already for, you know, 7 or 8 hours without email, I was in my room, and I hadn't got the cable to allow me to connect. And I was in terrible panic, particularly as the hotel had no idea what I was talking about.
Oh, thank God for that new midtown one on 55th Street opposite the Sony Plaza. Thank God for that. Anyway, that's dreadful. I've been there. God, I've been there. Listen, now, we shall return to this subject, of course. In the meantime, let's turn and stare at the work-in-progress guest until he blushes. For it's our chance to talk to someone about something they're currently engaged in, not something they're on the circuit to plug. Today, the Burgundy Hyde wing chair cups and moulds the delicious form of one of Britain's foremost comedy heroes. He wrote most of Not the 9 o'clock News, as well as Rowan Atkinson's first magical one-man show back in the late 70s and early 80s, co-created with Rowan Atkinson Blackadder, created the Vicar of Dibley, launched and still devotes a quarter of his entire life to comic relief, and is, I may say, shameless and hectoring in his unstinting efforts to force the unwilling carcasses of comic persons to serve that indefatigable cause. He wrote to Four Weddings and a Funeral, FWAF, which was, until the advent of those Sheffield strippers, Britain's most successful ever cinema comedy. Duncan Kenworthy, the amiable producer of that film, said of this former Harrow School head boy and winner of an Oxford First, "People always assume when someone is charming, funny, generous, caring and nice that they're hiding something, but Richard really is that person." Richard Curtis is father to a little girl called Scarlett, with the help of companion and love bounce Emma Freud. In fact, he is a low, cowardly, mean, two-faced, runty, graceless and witless oik, but the world will never know that. Richard, work in progress. I hear whispers swelling to a roar of a successor to FWAF.
We're in the middle of editing another film, yes, which I actually saw a cut of today.
And is it the same team as Mike Newell directing and Duncan Kimmel?
No, Duncan is producing. Mike's in America making a movie about air traffic control. So this is directed by a wonderful director called Roger Michell. Apart from that, Hugh's in it.
Grant, that is, I take
it. Hugh, yes. Grant is in it, that's right.
You made him, you couldn't break him. And what do we have a title? I think not.
Oh, it's been called Notting Hill so far, and as I watched it today, that seemed to me a rather odd title again, so who knows what we'll call it. The very long film, I think, would be a good name for it.
And I believe Julia Roberts is the co-star.
Julia Roberts is in it too, that's right.
And was that an experience uniformly joyous for you?
Yeah, it was. It was a great pleasure, in fact. You do dread the moment when you come across that movie nightmare when someone won't come out of their trailer because their cheeks aren't looking sufficiently rouged. But we had none of that. She behaved gorgeously and was sweet and said the lines that had been written for her, which is...
For a writer, a particular pleasure. Doug, you have said rather sweetly that your films, you tend to be unable to write about anything except your own experience, which is why your films and your comedy is so pitifully thin and vapid, which is typical modesty of yours. But I suppose people often think of you as a kind of English Woody Allen. I don't mean that in any, you know, real sense, other than that you're prepared to show yourself as a male who is sort of
charmingly insecure and jolly, and you don't try and write films in which you recreate the life of an Andean coffee planter or indeed in which planes blow up. I mean, you write about your orbit and so on. People who know you always hear in jokes.
Because I did write the film of Mr. Bean last year, so whether or not you're claiming that I'm like that character, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I never think of the leading character as being myself, but I think of him as a sort of lazy way of getting the other characters to be interesting. He's kind of informal, relaxed, central person who's a conglomerate of various people I know and conveniently does what he's asked to do.
You also said that if people don't want to go to bed with the lead, then you might as well pack up and go home. Is that quite true of Bean? I don't know. Am I the only one here who hasn't had strange fortissimo fantasies about Mr. Bean? Perhaps I am.
There are one or two people.
I'm sure. Fancy. Yes, no, I mean, no disrespect to Rowan, but the character.
Obviously, he's not a sexual thing.
No.
That's true. Yeah, no, and the great joy about working with people like you and Junior is they are so much better looking than the people on whom they're based.
More tightly buttocked. But one of the things I know, I don't want to embarrass you by over talking about your achievement with Comic Relief, and I know that some people get very irritated by Comic Relief because they don't like the idea of custard being thrown around and English being sort of organised in their silliness. But what everyone's feeling about that, I don't think anyone can deny the astonishing amount of money that has gone onto the continent of Africa and indeed to people in this country. And it seems to be something you're endlessly carrying on with, that you're not passing it over to anyone else. I mean, it's literally a quarter of your life, isn't it? Six months every other year.
Yes, that's right. It's a bit more than that, in fact. But the problem is, having got oneself into a position where you can make such an unrealistic amount of money simply by being there. I think that's the thing about Comic Relief for everybody. Whenever you ask a comedian to do something, you are really saying there is a chance if you give us a day, you might make £500,000 by doing this thing. And I've got myself trapped in a corner whereby still being there and doing it, I can help make £25 million every 2 years.
And I know we've got a meeting in a few days ourselves because you want to send me to Africa.
Yes, Stephen, that's absolutely right. And how gorgeous you will look there in your hat.
I will do my best not to get Bill Hartz here and embarrass everybody with a money.
We're hoping you do get Bill Hartz here. It'll be so exciting and dramatic in the documentary. We want you to be ill.
Oh, great. Now, the man who has no music in him nor is not moved by concord of sweet sounds is fit only for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. Something like that, anyway. I suppose you have no objection to the violin, Holmes asked Watson when they first proposed to share lodgings together. A well-played violin, said Watson, is a treat for the gods. A badly played one. Well, we're about to hear a violin well played. Played as the great makers of Cremona would never have guessed it could be played. Marat Bisengaliev of Kazakhstan, one more in the line of superb graduates from the Tchaikovsky Conservatoire in Moscow, stunned British audiences with his Wigmore Hall debut. He plays everything from the great virtuoso repertoire to new works, most notably the British composer Havergal Brian's astounding concerto for violin. For us, he picks up his 18th century instrument and plays Paganini's 23rd violin solo because I'm a tart and I asked him for it. Thank you. record the pleasure of hearing something done very, very, very well. And we turn now with equal pleasure and equal delight to John Sessions, a man recently described as possessing the wit of a Max Beerbohm, the panache of a Cecil Beaton, and the social flair of a sodding warthog. Johnny, you've been turning your attention to this problem I was delineating earlier, communications, internet, email, and associated howdy-dos. I understand that some of the legends of British theatre have been brushing with cyberspace.
Oh, work, please. No, this is unbearable, Alec. I'm just going to have to revert to my beloved Parker 51 and a friendly sheaf of monogrammed vellum. This machine is infernal. I can't get it to write anything. It just sits there looking at me, hating me.
It doesn't hate you, John, but it is a toaster. Now, over here is your spanking new Macintosh. Now, it's very simple. Let me guide your hand.
Oh, no! No.
Take the mouse, and so. Point and click, point and click.
Oh, you make me sound like a flamenco dancer with a deficiency of breeding.
Your fingers must indeed dance, John, but to the music of Macintosh. Unless, that is, you'd rather sashay along the stony path of IBM.
Oh, Alec, you've never been the same since you did that film with all those terrible Daleks and Triffids, that starfish thing.
That Star Wars thing, John. But an even greater galaxy of possibility and illimitable application lies beneath your fingertips. Now, this letter you've written. Dear lovely people at the gas board, my oven has become fearfully peculiar. Please fly to my aid. Bless you, Gielgud. A beautiful epistle. Now, we're going to send it by email. There. I have also left you my email address, so that you can communicate with me in London at any time you wish. My address is alec.piousobserveroprinciplefeastdays. Please retain the mass in the original Latin dot. And here is yours, John. John G. Dot, used to be splendid in Plantagenet hats dot, not averse to touring but only the home counties dot, gossip yes, philosophy no dot. Now, I've also arranged for you to be on the net, the World Wide Web.
Oh, it all sounds so ghastly and spidery.
The net is not at all spidery, John. Although one must always be vigilant against bugs, bugs can cause havoc with the neo-divine order bequeathed by the microchip. I know, let's access Larry's website.
Oh, it would be just like Lawrence to be in a web. Oh, but Lawrence has gone. Ralph, too.
Yes, gone. They have all gone into the dark. The vacant interstellar spaces. I'm sorry. Elliot's quartets are always with me. Yes, they're gone, John, but not forgotten. There we are, Olivia's website, his other shrine, in all its ubiquitous splendor, imminent like our Maker, and like our Maker, accessible to all believers. Oh, what's happening? Oh, the picture's going, and the cursor isn't answering the mouse.
Oh, it's broken. Oh, splendid. Look, let's go to the V&A. There's a splendid exhibition of costumes worn by dear Madge Titheridge.
Patience, John. This machine can no more be broken than my faith in the only true church. Goodness, I don't believe it.
Alec, what on earth are you doing?
Angels and ministers of grace defend us.
Oh, Alec, it's Lawrence. He's come back as a ghost. Oh, don't be ridiculous, John. I never played ghosts in the theater, and I have no intention of starting now. Then what are you?
What am I?
I'm a theatrical legend, you impertinent nonagenarian.
Alec, you blasted quatermass. What business have you got accessing me from Felicity? I was enjoying the most lavish praise from Kemble and MacReady, and then all of a sudden I'm sitting here like a rissole in a microwave.
It's a spiritual visitation, Lawrence. I was just saying the other day in an email I sent to Monsignor Ronaldo in Rome, one cannot predict the intervention of the infinite.
Oh, Alec, do put a purple sock in it. Warbling on like the Pope from arsehole to breakfast time.
It's old Graham Greene's fault. He said so the other day. Said he should never have encouraged you. Now, get me back to wherever I was, being told that I was brilliant by Victorian also-ran.
Oh, vanity, vanity. All is vanity.
Alec, darling, it really is time you were martyred. Preferably by a truck. Now, Johnny, what on earth was that preposterous film you made?
Prospero's Books? Incomprehensible as a Hindustani train timetable, sugar.
And then, to add insult to injury, you had to scamper around in the altogether and frighten people witless. It really is time you came over to the other side while they still think you're noble and serene and not the silly old duffer you've become.
Oh, I won't be ordered around by you anymore, Lawrence.
You hear? Now you're gone, I'm top knight.
Now, John, I think that honor can scarcely be accorded to any one individual. There is, shall we say, an ever-dwindling brotherhood.
Oh, Lawrence, there you are. Oh, hello. Ah, there's Johnny and Alec.
Oh, Ralph, you've arrived in the nick of time, just like the seventh heaven. I mean dwarfs. I mean, what do they call those dusty American boys with blue chemises and sabers?
This is incomprehensible. I only access Lawrence. Ah, the ways of cyberspace are wondrous strange. There is more in heaven and earth.
No! Ralph! Do switch off that blasted motorbike!
Don't you like it, Lawrence? It's just a little perk. A cherry on the cake of paradise. Isn't this topping? Here we are in Johnny's apple mat, like two goldfish in a bowl. Come on, Johnny, Alec. Shuffle off those shoddy mortal coils and swim in the bracing surf of cyberspace.
Alec, will you just close my website and let me get the hell out of here? Edmund Keane and I are due to have a limping competition before lunch.
Very well. I shall return the screen to its customary cerulean blue.
Thank you. And I don't want to see you again until you've joined us up here. And perhaps not even then.
Oh, Lawrence. Always rushing off. Still impetuous, even in death. Oh, Johnny, Alec, we're all so close again. Could all be back at the Vic. I can smell the leather of the gauntlets, the 5 and 9, the lamps that lit our magic court when we were kings.
Yes, we were all kings, and soon to meet the King of Kings.
Well, like I said, let's slip off now. You too, Johnny. Join Lawrence and me. It's very congenial. One has such fun cocking up the more imbecilic messages of regular net nuts. There's room for 3 of us on this bike. It's a very big one.
Why not? Elijah ascended to heaven on a chariot. Why not me on a Harley Davidson?
Oh, very well. I'm getting tired of sitting in caravans waiting to do cameos. I'll just fix the burglar alarm, as you from your crimes would pardon be. Let your indulgence set me free.
I regularly communicate with Bill Gates. Do you think the 3 of us might be able to ameliorate his dreadful speaking voice?
Johnny, thank you so much, as always. Bravo. Wonderful. As I say, it is always a pleasure to hear someone doing something quite wonderfully well. As in words once royal and valued, I'm able to say, Mr. Dalliard, we have a 3-way. 3 guests to talk to. Communication, IT literacy, the digitalization of everything. The convergence of television, music, radio, internet, computer, fax and telephone into one binary language offers astonishing powers and possibilities. But to whom? To us? Or to BT, AT&T, Cable and Wireless, Mr. Gates and Mr. Murdoch? Will we be further enslaved by the tyranny of choice or enfranchised by the personal empowerment offered us by our virtual transporter systems? To help us with an insider's view of things digital, we have Sue Thexton, quondam General Manager of Adobe Systems in Northern Europe. Adobe gave the world PostScript and Photoshop and Acrobat PDFs and ATM and many other industry standards. She is now, no more, I promise, of too much jargon, she is now UK Managing Director of Macromedia, familiar to any Webster as creators of Shockwave, one of the few browser plugins that you really need. But what if communications are spin doctoring, image creation and news controls? Blimey, there's a handful. To help us with that side of things, we have Hal James, who has worked in advertising and public affairs for John Major, Cable and Wireless and the BBC, whither he has returned to overhaul its publicity machine through his company, Brown Lloyd James. For a sane overview, did I say sane? We have Douglas Adams, author, of course, of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and therefore canonised on this radio station as of right, the first man in the UK to buy a Macintosh and the second man in the UK to buy a Macintosh. I was the third. Since then, he has bought even more of the darling things than I have, knows more than I could guess at about computers, MIDI, HTML, Java and the whole damn thing, runs a company called the Digital Village, which has produced a wow of a game called Starship Titanic, only available on Windows as yet, boo, and can, in all conscience, be called an original net hero. A netizen, one of the good guys, passionate and committed, but not to the point of fundamentalist zealotry. I'd like to turn first to Hal James. You've worked for Cable and Wireless, under Lord Young, I believe, and others, and you've worked for the BBC and for the government. Do you think the latter two, the BBC and the government, state-owned as it were, have the faintest idea of the plans, ambitions, money-making potential of the first private telecommunication companies? They're going to take the whole thing over, aren't they? It's theirs now, not ours.
Yes.
That's a good answer, but a frightening one, isn't it?
I think the government do understand it. I mean, I flicked through, you know, my little bit of bedtime reading was their recent paper about regulating all of this and convergence. They're coming at this, I think, the government, from the perspective that, you know, it's not here yet, and so we don't need to do anything about it. And, I mean, there's a very elegant little introduction about all of this, which talks about lean forwards, lean backwards, and rugged foldability. And what elegant. They're saying is that the convergence isn't upon us because, you see, you've got to lean forward for your PC, but most of us like leisure and entertainment on a lean backward mode. You see, I'm a lean backward person myself. I mean, I love the net, and I love playing on it, and I love being on it. I watch people who are much better at it than I. But it's not something I have become completely kind of, you know, sort of enthralled in yet.
Now, Sue, as someone from inside the industry, it's in your interest, obviously, to get everybody to be on the web all the time, because a lot of your business is in things like web plugins and so on, and in creating industry standards for web use, and in order indeed to convert to television and the web, quite specifically video streaming and all these other things, I believe they're called. Do you ever stop to think, do you have kind of, as it were, philosophy moments with yourself or with your team where you think, actually, what are we really doing here? Are we just being sucked into the maws of something bigger than us, or can we control it in a positive way, or can we step back and look at it as we're doing it?
No, I mean, I think it's something that we do spend a lot of time actually thinking about, and we meet people all of the time where we're trying to sort of talk about some of the better experiences that you can have on the web, to look at some of the interesting sites that are out there and the real benefits that can be gained from it, as opposed to always focusing on the negative stuff, which is often what a lot of the media tends to focus on. You know, you mentioned also that, you know, the pornography. But there are great opportunities, and, you know, it is very important that I think we, as part of the industry, do have a responsibility of trying to open up that wonderful world to as many people as possible.
There's bonhomous good cheer here, Douglas Adams, and both Hal and Sue seem quite sort of, you know, chipper about the whole thing. We're not good at predicting the future. We never have been as a race. Do you think we can really know what's going on?
Well, it's very interesting that the computer industry, which is more than any other industry, focused on the future, was the one that didn't spot that the end of the century was coming.
Yes, the millennium bug is a very good example.
I think it's very important not to be sort of hypnotized by the Blade Runner vision of the future, which is that it's going to all look like sort of outskirts of Los Angeles and rain a lot.
Yes.
Because if we think that's what it's going to be like, then that's what we're going to bring about.
Well, that's the
it's
problem.
Only by being optimistic about the future we'll actually bring it about.
Self-fulfilling prophecies can be the devil, yeah.
Exactly. And I feel we live in a culture over here in England of this. I mean, every time anybody brings out some new technology, you'll hear people on, you know, the Today programme or World at One say, oh, what is this, all this newfangled stuff that all these boffins are doing, we don't want any interest in this.
I'm sure there was a time when newspapers came out and said, I can't possibly understand, I get my 3-year-old child to open the pages for me, I can't work them out at all, I don't understand how it works.
We were terribly scarred with 8-track and Beta and VHS, isn't that where it all started?
Yes, I know, but this is all the sort of junk, you know, DNA, yeah, that we need. This is the compost. This is the compost out of which the good things go. I mean, the idea that every new thing that's going to come out is going to be great is obviously nonsense, but it's only because you go through, you know, 10 iterations of stuff that is rubbish, that you suddenly get something great.
And what's interesting about, if I can just interrupt, Douglas, sorry, is about the net, whatever that means, its world of internets and other such communication, is that it isn't an object. It isn't an object invented. It's sort of an organic growth. I mean, you can take that too far. Mm. But sometimes people have said to me, especially in the early days, well, what use is it? It's much quicker to look in a book. And I can get this quicker, and it's not. And that's asking the wrong question of it. It's like saying, what use is London? It takes me ages to cross town to get to the British Museum. Well, yes, it does, and it's got slums, and it's got Soho and prostitutes, and it's got nasty people living in nasty areas, and it's got rich snobs living in other areas, but it's a city, it's alive, and the net is like that. It is not something that you use a resource or a tool, is it?
There was a British Home Secretary who said about the telephone that it was all very well for the Americans, they'd probably take to this very, very well, but here in England we had so many office boys that we would never actually need it.
The mayor of Boston, who made another.
Oh, the mayor of Boston, who being shown a telephone. I mean, he was the other side. I mean, he really felt this is tremendously exciting, and he said, "Call me a fool, call me anything you like, but I will make a prediction, which is that one day, this fantastic instrument. One day there will be one of these in every single American city. So, you know, we never, ever get it right. But I think it's tremendously important that we think about the positive things that we can do with all this technology, because it's coming anyway.
People are going to put too much on it. That it's going to find, you know, the weight on its shoulders. You know, there's so much expectation. We read so much about, you know, the convergence, the benefits, the information, the access, the, you know, the empowerment that Stephen was talking about earlier. I mean, can it take this huge burden of expectation?
It's rather like,
and will it create a backwash?
It's utopian idealism that was put upon television and indeed wireless when it first came out, was that it would inform and that it would make people wiser and better read, and all the adverts on American, you know, television for America Online and things show little children with encyclopedia-y type things looking up cheetahs and so on. And in fact, we know that really that's not the way television developed, although we have learned a lot from all kinds of programs.
I think we'll find when we go downstairs, downstairs or upstairs, I can't remember, we'll find in the lobby of Broadcasting House still that motto of the BBC, which is "Nation shall speak peace unto nation." Mm. No, it doesn't quite happen like that. Technology doesn't make you better.
But at least speak unto nation is one thing, even if it's not peace.
Yes. But I do think even if technology can't make life better, it can consistently and continually make life much, much more interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's going to make life hugely interesting for your average political spin doctor.
But Sue, is it going to create an underclass? I mean, at the moment, I believe 7 million in this country are on the net in some form or another. Mostly, the majority are 35 male and reasonably prosperous. Very small percentage above 55, I think about 7%. And when you look around the rest of the world, of course, it's used as a lifeline politically in places like China by a small number of students and dissidents and so on. But just as in anything else, you know, the poor gets poorer in the information economy, as it were, and the rich gets richer, and a bloody shame, as they used to sing.
Well, there's certainly a lot of talk about this supposed digital underclass, but, you know, basically, you know, there is a huge amount of growth going on here, and gradually more and more people are going to be becoming far more comfortable using the technology and able to get access to the technology as well, which is a good thing. But, you know, you were saying there that the stereotype, really, of a typical user at the moment is this sort of 35-year-old male. There was a recent survey by KPMG, which said that currently in Britain, 31% of people on the web are women, which I found a very surprising figure, but I was delighted to see that it was as high as 31%. But that is increasing far more than the sort of take-up of
There's always a danger of using statistics like the drunk uses a lamppost for support rather than illumination. But it's good. That's good. That is a good positive thought. Now, Hal, you made some point about it helping spin doctors. I mean, some of us had the vague hope that it might hinder them because it's no longer that they're in control of information.
Well, I think it's going to make their life very interesting. It's going to put some of them in intensive care. Because there's going to be so much. I mean, the whole process of political spin is about managing different time sections of the day. I mean, this sort of started in 87 during that election. I mean, it was brought to its kind of absolute height in 92 and 97, where you take chunks of the kind of media agenda, the breakfast period, the mid-morning, the lunchtime, the late afternoon, the evening, and you feed them. You feed this voracious media animal with something. You give them a big interview, you give them a speech, you give them an article they can report on, you float some sort of policy initiative, whatever it is. Now, I don't see how spin doctors, as they are trained today, are going to control something like the net. The net is going to come at them, and it's going to come at them in both a kind of controlled way, which is that, you know, the kind of legitimate sources of information, which are going to be rolling out and churning out, you know, all the time. It's also going to come in an illegitimate way, which is you're going to have these wonderfully playful people who are going to put up these notice boards and are going to promulgate all the wicked and terrible tales that run around kind of street newsrooms and run around political parties during an election.
And
they're going to be suddenly up there, and they're going to be legitimised by being up there.
And indeed, subjudice laws, for example, are meaningless on the web. Mm. I mean, for example, the Rosemary West trial for a time was subjudice, and one could read about it every day on the net, because it was published in Canada or America or whatever.
No, people are going to have to throw their hands up and just kind of go roll with it, I think.
Hal, one of the things that interested me... I don't want to get too indiscreet here, but your oppo at the time of the last election was Peter Mandelson, of course, who did well. But I remember, not that long before the election, showing him his first ever website. And he's the man who is generally regarded, perhaps wrongly, as being the sort of modern spirit of spinning and media control. And he went, oh, that's rather wonderful. What does that do? And let's have a look at the Labour Party one. And there was we eventually found one with a few roses stuck on it somewhere, and a list of all the Labour MPs, three of which actually actually were kind of highlit in the text because they actually had email addresses and no more than that. And then we turned to the conservative one, and there was a thing of John Major speaking to the people, and it was actually
very
much
nice
it was much better than the Labour Party one, which is rather surprised. And he was making, you know, trying to make some point that every great, you know, telecommunications advance had been made under conservative governments and not under Labour governments.
But get him in when you can.
But,
you know.
Yeah, exactly. But it astonished me and continues to astonish me, and I don't mean you to be indiscreet, the really quite extraordinary ignorance of politicians when you meet them on subjects like telecommunications. You know, they make grand claims about internet for every classroom without really knowing what an internet is.
No, so I think that is a dilemma, but I think it's a dilemma that goes wider than just the net, I have to say, about politicians.
Television. Yes,
I mean, that
Richard Curtin.
Endless comments about television.
Richard is right. They're not available for a lot of the normal life experiences that we all share because they are overwhelmed with their desire to engage in the political game which has obsessed them since usually when they were.
So inserting a laptop into the red boxes may be a good idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it may help. I think, I tell you who's changing that culture, and I think it's the private offices. And I think, you know, lots of young, bright people in the civil service and young, bright people within the political parties who understand and know the power of this and are bringing people to it. So I think it's happening. I wouldn't be too bleak about it.
Excellent. Well, thank you all very much. I don't know if anything's been decided, but it's been lovely listening to you. Nice people, good people. Richard Coles, our occasional regular musical pasticheur par excellence, has been thinking about what lessons can be drawn from our rapid movement musically into an era of telecommunications.
Well, if we've learned one thing from the communications age, it's that of the heap of broken images which comprises our fragmented culture, no pre-Einsteinian spatiotemporal manifold can now be made. Oh, and that just because Carol Vorderman can tell the difference between a vowel and a consonant, it doesn't mean she's Simone de Beauvoir. But where did this fracturing, so characteristic of our time, occur? I reckon it was in France, that crucible of revolution, probably around the turn of the century. So it was to the music of that period I turned. And what a cracking idea that was, because encoded in the piano music of Satie, Poulenc and Debussy, concealed within the impressionistic colours and faux naïf formalisms of these three, I found some extraordinary passages which seem to prefigure and anticipate the sounds of our own age, truly signature tunes of cultures in crisis. Example one, this little-known pastorelle of Francis Poulenc. Mesdames, Messieurs, it's intertextuality, and it's on the Rive Gauche. Emboldened, I widened my parameters and turned to Eric Satie, discovering the unpublished working manuscript for Gymnopédie. I was shocked to find this therein. Well, the manuscript sadly self-destructed after 5 seconds. But what about the music of Debussy, the giant of French pianism before the First World War? Could evidence of future cultural trends be found in the dense, ironic textures and fluid, flexible lines of the hydrocephalic Parisian? The answer is an emphatic oui. Between the whole tone scale and standing in a field in Yorkshire with your hand up a cow's backside. Merci et bonsoir.
Oh, and merci, Richard Coles. God bless him. What a beautiful way to end the programme. Thank you all very much indeed. And great merciful heavens, huge flaming balls of lordy, bless me, excuse me, bounce me to perdition, tickle my nipples, use me roughly and call me Maureen. Have you seen the time? Ladies and gentlemen, business is about to be suspended. We have sauces to deglaze, flapjacks to turn out and tomatoes to dry in the sun. Prepare to disengage. Issue a farewell command to your IRC chums, jack out of the matrix, log off from the ISP, reinitialize the modem with an ATZ and a goodness me. In 15 seconds, we will be offline, but not until we have closed this evening's active windows. Douglas Adams, Richard Curtis, John Sessions, Sue Thexton, Howell James, Marat, Bissem Galiev, each receive a grateful click in their close boxes, as does our remote server, Richard Coles. This is the hard disk of Stephen Fry, spinning down. Until next time, all love. Bye-bye.